51 Things You Should Never Say to a Mother, Ever. 1. Your daughter is so beautiful, so you're saying she's dumb. 2. Your daughter is so smart, so you're saying she's ugly. 3. So great how you give him so much freedom, so you're saying I neglect him. 4. He's really lucky to have a parent who's so attentive, so you're saying I smother him. 5. Hello. Racist. 6. How are you? Doesn't recognize the struggle. 7. Would you like a refill on that coffee? Starts sobbing. 8. Boarding pass, please. Isn't that so like you? 9. The weather this afternoon at San Francisco International Airport is 63 degrees and foggy. I can't even. 10. I haven't seen you in so long. You've obviously been busy. You did not just. 11. You look tired. Oh, my God. 12. You look great. Oh, my God. 13. Your son knows more about computers than I do, so you're saying my house is a hedonistic den of screen time. 14. I wish my daughter liked being outside as much as your daughter does, so you're saying she's doomed to die penniless and alone because she doesn't know how to code. 15. How can I help? So you're saying I look like I need help. 16. Can I get you anything at the store? So you're saying I look like I'm out of everything. 17. Would your kids like to come with us to go get ice cream? So you're saying I look like I'm anti-ice cream at home. 18. How was your summer? I cried a lot. 19. Oh, 2, 4, and 6 are such great ages. Ma'am, don't mock me. 20. It gets easier. How dare you? 21. Looks like you have your hands full. I said, how dare you? 22. Such a beautiful day, isn't it? I just. 23. Merry Christmas. Seriously, go fuck yourself. 24. This coffee cake is delicious. So you're saying I like missionary in particular. 25. I love what you've done with your house. Feminism just called. It said it's dead. The funeral is at 3. 26. How long have you been breastfeeding? Long enough to know this is a trick question. 27. It's fine to give your baby a bottle. Don't listen to those nursing Nazis. Starts sobbing. 28. Your husband is such a good dad.
Yeah, men tend to really shine at about the 35% parenting level.
29. Being a mother is hard.
So you're saying I make it look not easy.
30. Being a mother is a gift.
Where's my receipt?
31. Being a mother is the best job there is.
And the profit sharing? Woo-hoo, boy!
32. Being a mother is thankless.
Am I talking to myself again? I am. I can tell.
33. He's an angel.
Don't tell me. You're a grandmother?
34. He's an angel sent straight from heaven.
I told you to stay out of this, Holly Hunter.
35. Can I take your order?
Starts sobbing.
36. Would you like a dressing room?
Yes, because I would like to threaten my children in private.
37. How's it going in there?
You know how it's going in here.
38. Need any other sizes?
If you say bigger, I will stuff this sweater down my pants.
39. Thank you.
Wow.
40. Please come again.
Can you even hear yourself?
41. Would you like to take it for a test drive?
Off a cliff with you in it?
Yes. 42. Or should we wait for your husband?
To knee you square in the 1950s? No, I can do that myself.
43. So how did it handle?
The thing is just so well honed. Not only is its electrically assisted steering system unexpectedly sensitive, you can practically feel the thousands of man-hours spent developing its Michelin tires, its stiffer structure, and, on Z51 models, its electronically controlled limited-slip differential. Even on narrower rubber, the C7 has grip figures on par with the outgoing Z06. Okay, fine, I got that from Car and Driver.
44. Wow, he's gotten so tall.
So you're saying he's too big for his age?
45. Oh my gosh, look at those tiny feet.
So you're saying she's too small for her age?
46. Look at that belly.
I hope you're talking about my kid.
47. Look at that naked bummy.
Seriously, please be talking about my kid. Why are you naked right now? You're 12.
48. Look at you all together. What a beautiful family.
Starts sobbing.
49. Did you see that movie that just came out?
I don't know. Was it called Fuck Me for Having Friends Who Have a Life?
50. Did you read that new book?
Busy doing a little something over here called Helping the Human Race Continue. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to get back up on my cross.
51. Don't you ever wonder what that sweet baby is thinking?
Oh, I know exactly what he's thinking. I hate everyone.
Is there a parenting expert on this plane?
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking. We're now at a cruising altitude of 30,000 feet, and I've turned off the fasten seatbelt sign. Feel free to get up, stretch your legs, and move about the cabin. Also, while I have your attention, it seems there's a child in 9D who is completely incapable of spreading cream cheese onto his bagel by himself, and there's growing concern in that section of the aircraft that he doesn't have enough grit. Is there a parenting expert on this plane?
Great. The flight attendant is telling me 153 of you are. She also mentioned that his mother didn't raise her hand. Interesting. Look, today it's cream cheese, tomorrow it's not being able to slather lubricant on an ultrasound wand. It's just never too early for the general public, specifically white men in positions of power, to step in and tell women they're so very wrong, and to detail all the ways they're so very wrong. I also find it never hurts, me, to explain things to them in a way I might to a small child. Mom, would you like a pair of pilot wings?
No, I insist.
Quick show of hands. How many of you believe 9D can't spread his big baby cream cheese due to the fact his mother doesn't allow him to free range enough? And by enough, I mean an acceptable amount according to strangers on the playground, neighbors, and those of us heading to Chicago this afternoon, where the weather is a mild 72 degrees and it's partly cloudy, none of whom know this family personally? I'm being told 148.
Yes, that's what I was afraid of.
Is there a tiger mom in the house? Anyone raise their kid in France? Any kids on board who manage their parents' finances? Hold on, I'm being told that the boy in 9D is 4 years old and this is his first time flying. And now I'm getting a message from the control tower. Yep, got it. Okay, they said, and I quote, "Oh, boo-hoo. Sounds like the excuses of someone who will never be able to hold down a job or find happiness in the arms of a life partner." They also suggested I put my fists up at the outer corners of my eyes and curl them in and out to make the internationally recognized sign of the crybaby, like this. But hey, by all means, 9D's mom, keep spreading his cream cheese for him. Jesus. I mean, who am I? Just some guy who holds all your lives in his extremely independent, staying dry at night, spreading cream cheese all by himself hands. Look, no one has time for this, 9D. It's time you put your big boy pants on and change the oil on your mom's car when you get home. What do you mean you don't know how? That's it. I've had enough of this. Does anyone know how to fly a plane?
The co-captain. Of course, apologies. Please take over, Todd.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking from in front of you right now in the middle of the aisle. The flight attendants will be starting beverage service soon, and I suggest you order a double, because we've got some serious meddling and undermining to do. Look, how can we get 9D to step it up over here? Feel free to just shout out your craziest, most judgmental thoughts.
Tell the boy's mother everything she's doing wrong, but also get something in there about cherishing every moment. It goes by so fast, etc., etc., etc.
Yes, good. Look on disapprovingly, no matter what's happening. Well, that certainly is a timeless one. Diagnose the child even though I work in a bank. Perhaps suggest 9D is autistic and ask the mother if she ever saw Claire Danes in that Temple Grandin movie because it was marvelous.
Creative, cultural, and on trend. I really like where you're going with that one.
Just sigh a lot and act exasperated, as though I myself was never a small child who had to learn self-control and life skills. And then pivot to add a dig in there, like, I suppose you're one of those working mothers who has someone else raising her kid for her? Because it obviously shows. Something like that.
Perhaps a bridge too far, but interesting. Okay, food for thought. Another quick show of hands. Will this child eventually be able to spread cream cheese on his own simply by maturing and learning skills at his own pace?
2.
What are you even thinking, 23A? And Mom to 9D, please stay out of this. Or will he only be able to get a grip if his mother quits her job and commits to being at home full-time, which is the natural habitat for those of you with vaginas who have been through the ringer? 152. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Last, are we helping or hurting? One vote for hurting, 152 for helping. Hold up, the one vote for hurting is from the boy's mother. Ma'am, I said stay out of this. Look, if there's one thing I think we can all agree on, it's that all of us, except one, are right. No one knows what's better for a child than someone who has precious little information about that child or his circumstances. Bonus points if it's been at least 3 decades since you've parented a young child yourself. Double bonus points if you've never had any children at all. Who's with me on this? First class, I can't hear you. Very last row in front of the bathrooms. Holla! Oopsie-daisy, apparently that made 9D cry. Well, that's hardly surprising, is it? Everyone in coach? Let me hear you scream. Freedoms. Do you have faith in me? Do you have faith in me? My daughter shout asked from across the skate park. She stood there, helmet and pads on, never having been on a skateboard before, opting for a scooter at this birthday party, as she considered going down a small ramp. Do you have faith in me? She repeated, this girl who is nothing if not supremely confident. In just a 6-word question, she summed up the last 11 years of my life, of trying to control my worry, my anxiety, real anxiety, to have faith in me, in them, in the world. For me, raising children has been one long strength-building exercise in self-control. Not the kind of self-control that really matters. I yell, throw tantrums, slam my fist down on the table when everything's unraveling. But the kind of control it takes to keep my anxiety wrestled into a submissive position, to remind myself tragedy isn't the only option, to attempt to hide from them I'm worried. I'm always worried. Becoming a mother made my anxiety, a thing I never really thought I had, explode into a technicolor display of irrational imagination. In just the 60 seconds it took me to hustle down to our roadside mailbox and back, I imagined in graphic detail how it had been just enough time for our 2 lazy dogs to rip my infant son apart, to pull him from his cushion-enclosed nap spot on the couch and devour him in a feeding frenzy. It was the thing that made every trip to a playground, bike path, or pool one long stress test for me, cringing and shouting, "Be careful!" But it never inoculated them from anything. Not her falling from the monkey bars in a position that can only be described as invisible chair when I thought she had broken her tailbone. It didn't inoculate him from choking on pool water, or either of them from falling, on their teeth, on the side of their heads, on their knees. It never protected them from anything. It never saved us a single trip to the ER. When my son was 6, he was diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder as a free gift with purchase with his Asperger's diagnosis. As parents, as humans, we're very quick to say, "So, okay, that's you, that's your thing. We should definitely, definitely work on that." It took me a while to realize, wait, hold up. I think that actually might be my thing, too. I slowly began to trace the web backward. My shyness as a kid, and to a lesser degree as an adult. My fear of speaking up, of saying the wrong thing, of saying anything in certain situations. My fear of hurting myself. I have clear memories of inching my way down our hill in winter to get to the school bus stop, careful to avoid the patches of ice hiding under the snow, waiting to betray me. It's why I don't ski, snowboard, mountain bike, and barely know how to swim. I've never plunged into a pool, jumped from a boat into a lake. The risks I take are creative and mostly theoretical. They are never physical. And when I thought I had a handle on it, had named it, or at least understood it was there, like a disloyal shadow, it turned on me. Last September, I prepared to get up in front of 80 people, the most open, supportive, enthusiastic 80 people possible, and make a brief 10-minute announcement. That's it. That's all. But the longer the first speakers took, the more I felt my nerves suddenly ramp up. My legs felt a little weak,
my heart about to explode. I told myself that this was just normal nervousness for me. I always felt nervous before speaking or presenting, but once I got up there and got rolling, I'd be fine.
Well, more or less fine. I'd be mostly fine. Plus, I had no idea what actually existed beyond normal nervousness.
But in what felt like a flash, my run-of-the-mill nervousness crossed a hard line it had never, not once, crossed before.
I imagined what walking up to the front of the room would feel like, and I was pretty sure it would feel like walking through oatmeal while wearing cement shoes. I felt my legs about to buckle.
I didn't faint, and although I had never fainted before, I was sure this must be what it felt like.
My chest tightened. I wasn't sure my legs actually even worked anymore. I couldn't imagine opening my mouth and anything coming out of it except moths and cotton.
And in that instant, it all came crashing down. I lurched over to my partner in this project, a partner not prepared to speak at all, threw her my notes and said, "I have to go," and walked out the side door just as my introduction was happening. It felt as fucked up, awful, and upsetting as you might imagine. I felt freaked out. I felt wildly unprofessional. I felt like an utter loser. I really didn't know what had happened. I still don't know what happened. A panic attack, I guess. My first. Maybe I wasn't eating enough, not enough protein. I wasn't sleeping a lot on that trip. We all drank together the night before. Maybe I was dehydrated.
I reasoned I had become either too comfortable or too lazy about rehearsing, something I had relied on previously to feel prepared and confident. I had underestimated I would need to do that in this situation, too.
I hadn't taken it seriously, nor prepared as I might otherwise, since this was supposed to be easy, quick, and casual. That's what everyone told me. I told myself that was the full story as well as the end of it. Just an anomaly. But 2 months later, I was in a meeting. A routine, mundane meeting. And as we went around to introduce ourselves, the longer it took to get to me, the more nervous I felt. And as soon as I thought, "I hope what happened in September isn't happening again," I triggered it.
I made it through, the thought of the humiliation greater than the anxiety, but barely.
My face was hot. I felt like I was speaking from underwater. Sweat prickled all over my body, and the taste of metal flashed in my mouth.
No one could have known I'd been seconds from fleeing, from passing out, from wanting out.
"Here, keep your money." I don't know what's happening, this anxiety that reshapes in me every 10 or 20 years. I don't know why this fear of the physical is now exploding into a fear of the interpersonal, the mundane, into the part of the world I felt like I had a handle on. I can trigger it the way you can conjure pain by pressing on a bruise or feel the electric zing of a loose tooth by pushing it with your tongue. I test it, which seems unwise, but frankly, I'm pissed about it. I didn't do anything you didn't want me to do, and now you want to take even more away from me? I didn't take risks. I kept myself safe. I've worked completely under the radar, and this is the thanks I get? Fuck you, anxiety. We always think we're alone in our misery, don't we? We think we're so special as to have problems and ailments that only we have experienced. We all think we're the next subjects of the diagnosis column in the New York Times. But every time I reveal something of myself, take the risk in asking a friend, "Has this ever happened to you?" the answer is almost always a shy, quiet yes. Miscarriage? Yes. Financial freakouts? Yes. Panic attacks? Yup. We're so afraid of failure. And anxiety feels like one long fucking failure. I've learned over time to avoid some of the situations where I'll hold my kids back, where I'll be nothing but a chorus of, "Be careful, be careful, be careful." Those are the things my husband fields, where he lets them be kids and take risks and get hurt and get back up again. They know I'm the parent who worries. I don't think they understand the true extent of it, but maybe I'm just being naive. Because by the time my daughter was 4 and I shouted, "Please be careful, watch what you're doing," as she scrambled up and over a rock embankment near the lake, she quietly replied down to the sand, "Mom, I'll be fine. Don't worry." Don't worry. As my children get older, more capable, I find myself loosening up. Maybe that's why my anxiety is now pointing inward, at myself, instead of outward, at them. My son has pushed past and learned to control so much of the anxiety that crippled him when he was little. But if I've learned anything, anxiety is as adaptable as a virus. It will be with him always. Even he understands this. So why can't I?
Maybe that's why my daughter's question rang out so clearly to me, hitting me square. I can still hear it ringing out. It's a question I've started asking myself.
Do you have faith in me?
I do, I yelled back in response to this question she had never, not once, asked me before. Tears leaped to my eyes, no one around us grasping the explosion of meaning in our exchange. A girl who scooted past her, a girl she had never met before, shouted, I have faith in you! And that seemed to mean just as much as my reply. She asked one last time, Do you have faith in me? I shouted back, I do! And the scooter girl zipped between us again and repeated, I have faith in you!
Do you have faith in me? I do. I have faith in you.
This circle so snug between the three of us, a mother, a daughter, a peer. In that moment, the balance so exquisite between what our parents tell us and what our peers encourage, how they become equal, one meaning as much as the other, even if that peer is a stranger. How the people who know us the least are sometimes just as much a vote of confidence as those who know us best. The people who know us well, giving us too much leeway, maybe support and feed our fears too much. The people who don't know us, believing anything is possible, push us and make us brave. We need both. I repeat this to myself now in a round. In those moments, the moments when I worry, the moments when I wonder, is this happening again? Could the worst happen? I think, do you have faith in me? I do. I have faith in you.
13. With dudes. If you have camped more than once, then you have had a best-worst camping trip. A best-worst camping trip is when everything somehow went wrong and right, where you were close to pulling the ripcord on the whole thing, but then were rewarded handsomely for staying the course. Maybe it started out with having to tarp an entire site and set up two tents in a crashing thunderstorm, as my husband and kids had to just a few weeks ago, finally retreating to the truck when it all became too unmanageable, too terrifying, and too sweary. How would I know if I wasn't there? Because these details, especially the swearing details, were the first things my kids blurted out when they busted through the door that Sunday afternoon. Regardless, sometimes thunderstorms give way to vivid rainbows seen in full, or a gorgeous afternoon of jumping off docks and lazy canoeing, or maybe an after-lunch nap in a shaded tent, skin warm and fragrant from sunscreen, piney bug spray, and sweat. And sometimes your worst moment is almost getting into a fistfight with people 20 years younger than you, only to tumble straight into the best idea in the entirety of the parenting canon. On this particular trip, we were camping at Burton Island State Park, an idyllic spot on an actual island in Lake Champlain. Meaning you need to take a ferry there. Meaning you can't just fill your car up to the rearview mirror with your crap and let it explode at your campsite. Meaning, this park is in such high demand, everyone reserves prime sites the year before and might be a bit amped by the time they get there, weighed down with bags and bikes and beer. Our campsite was tucked into the woods, with that elusive balance of shade and sunlight, and with a clear view of the lake across the path from us. We also had a view of all the lucky bastards who had reserved the lakefront sites and lean-tos, close enough to hear the teeny tiny lake waves lap at the rocks and exposed tree roots. I imagined them all being logged into the state park's reservation systems at midnight the day the sites came online. I admired them and hated them in equal measure. Our site was also located entirely too close, really within punching distance, to a group of 20-something fuckheads who only grew in number, dogs, and tequila as the night wore on. We overenthusiastically engaged our kids in conversation for the sole purpose of distracting them from the Kid Rock cruise on land that was unfolding next to us. Our kids were 8 and 10, and for some reason I felt like that was maybe a little too young to have to hear a bunch of dipshits and their chorus of simple sentences that were mostly constructed as such. Subject plus fucking plus verb plus fucking plus direct object. We kept them up late, knowing there was nothing regular about a regular bedtime in this situation.
Besides, we hoped the late night would push them over the edge sleepiness-wise and allow them to crash, even though they were only separated from dumbass Mageddon by a thin nylon barrier. John and I kept drinking, in the hopes it would also send us into a dead sleep. But mostly what it did was simultaneously take the edge off while creating new, different edges. The kind of edges attached to knife handles. We hated every single human being at that campsite. Like an old movie, the clock hands whirled fast past 9 p.m., then past quiet hours at 10 p.m., 11 p.m. Oh my God, midnight, how much do we have to drink to make this end? Finally, my non-confrontational husband teetered over to their site with his headlamp on and his millionth beer in hand. It took him maybe 5 steps total to get there. Pretty sure when he got there, one of the guys was slapping a girl's ass as they all hooted and hollered. I hate people. He piped up with a, "Guys, it's midnight. My kids are asleep. They've had to listen to you swearing and screaming all night. Can you wrap it up?" One loud mouth said something back that I think contained vowels and consonants, but mostly just sounded like Barney from The Simpsons. John came back. They started to break it up, meaning not go to bed but just take their booze and go to the edge of the water or up to the meadow, and I wouldn't have cared if they went to Mars as long as they got the hell away from us. We stayed by our fire for another few minutes, enjoying the break in our jaw-clenching battle of livers. In an attempt to stop fantasizing about shooting flaming arrows at their campsite, I noticed that the lakefront campsites and lean-tos across from us seemed to be occupied by one giant group. All of the adults over there were also still up, around their huge campfire. There were tons of kids, so many kids, now all asleep in their tents. When we had set up earlier that day, there were teenagers standing on the roofs of the lean-tos armed with super soakers and younger kids plastering themselves up against trees and tents, trying not to be seen. All-out war was constantly raging across at least 6 campsites. It was a borderless, lawless country. We were hemmed in by dipshits to the left and a sovereign nation in front of us. On a friggin' island, no less. A few things about this sovereign nation had caught my eye, however. I thought back and realized the kids were a crazy range of ages, from maybe 7 years old all the way up to teenagers and even college kids. Everyone gathered for meals, got ready for bed, brushed teeth, and set out for the day together. Kayaking, swimming, whatever, it was done in a group. It wasn't just one endless Lord of the Flies over there. Sure, it looked like that initially, but there was definitely a method to the madness. And above all else, the kids were really nice. I didn't totally approve of them tromping all over the roofs of the lean-tos, because come on. But when my son stood at the end of our campsite's pathetic little dirt path and stared longingly at all the fun they were having, 2 of the teenage kids, not the youngest kids, but teenagers, came over and said, "Hey, buddy, do you want to play?" and brought him into the fold. Something was going on. Something was off. But somehow something was very, very right. Like a dope slap to the side of the head, I whipped around to my husband and said, "There are no moms on that camping trip over there." And he looked at me, surveyed the scene, and laughed. "Holy shit, you're right." Suddenly, the absence of nagging, assorted soul-crushing instructions, and general fun-killing finally made sense. Not to mention all that fearless scaling of lean-tos. But those kids were happy. They were free and wild, yet not given a free pass to act like jerks, unlike the shitheads next to us. You should do that. You should have a camping trip like that. The very next summer, that's exactly what John did with our other dad friends and their kids. And Dad Camp was officially born. On Father's Day weekend, no less. I can't speak to the particulars of what unfolded over that first weekend, because they were not shared with me. I knew not to ask too many questions. 1, because I wouldn't get many answers. And 2, because I didn't really care. The kids were gone, I had a weekend to myself, and everyone came home on Sunday. What's to know? But the thing about kids who aren't teenagers yet is they will gladly narc on their dad given the slightest opportunity. Every year I've heard about which dads got in trouble with the park rangers and at least a handful of things they were specifically told not to tell the moms. Kids are double agents, man. You can't ever trust them. But what I do know From stories and videos and the random grab bag of photos I've seen over the past few years, is by the end of that weekend, there is one big bonded pack of filthy, happy kids, and another big bonded pack of relaxed, and also filthy and happy, dads. Dad camp is the younger version of the sovereign nation we witnessed on that best-worst camping trip. The youngest campers have been just 2 or 3 years old, and my son has always been the oldest, now at 13. They've dug in the clay at the edge of the water, wolfed down chocolate chip pancakes from the one dad who made those his specialty, and by default ended up feeding breakfast to every single kid on the trip. They've canoed and kayaked, gathered around campfires, and smacked each other with pool noodles. All without a, now what do you say? Or a be careful? Or a, are you hungry? They eat when the food is ready. They go brush their teeth when our friend Eric takes out his guitar and leads them in a toothbrushing song he makes up on the spot. This was such a big hit the first year a park ranger noticed and asked him if he would come back and perform at the state park. He declined, but it was a testament to the spirit this big pack of dads and kids brought to the trip, and to Eric's talent, enthusiasm, and improv abilities, of course. Typically, at some point, a group photo is taken. All the dads, all the kids. Usually it's raining. When I saw the group photo from the inaugural dad camp, my first thought was, these are good men. I have thought it every year since. My eyes scan their faces and I see creative directors and professors, musicians and marketers, a carpenter, writers. For some, that weekend is just one in a series of camping trips they'll pack into that summer. For others, it's the one time they'll camp all year. Every single one of these men is a good husband, a great father, a stellar human being. They are involved in their children's lives in ways mundane and profound, this trip being just one in a myriad of ways they model what fatherhood looks like now. They model what it should have looked like all along. They are involved. They are capable. They are smart and funny and let the kids be the unruly creatures they're meant to be. This year, Dad Camp fell not only on Father's Day weekend, as it usually does, but also on my son's 13th birthday. I am a serious birthday person. Not in the way that I go overboard when it comes to birthdays, although I sometimes do, but in the way that I clear everything from my calendar for my kids' birthdays. Even when I was working full-time, I made sure to take the day off. This tradition actually started with me, well before I had kids. All because one day, while I worked on my birthday, I came dangerously close to calling a client a cunt on a conference call. In my defense, she really was a cunt. But it seemed to me if I was expecting other humans to be especially nice and deferential to me on my birthday, work was not the place to spend my day. From that moment on, I always took my birthday off. And once I became a freelancer, hell, I'd take the whole week, month, off. Your birthday is your birthday, people. If you're not going to celebrate the hell out of it, then who will? Your mom, that's who. That's why I carried my tradition over to their birthdays. They're both summer babies, so I never had to contend with getting them out of school, but trust me, I would have. But this? I wasn't really prepared for this. For about 6.5 minutes, I entertained heading out to their campsite and bringing an ice cream cake. Then I thought about the logistics, how they'd need to definitely be there when I arrived or the cake would melt, how it'd be disruptive to their whole day. I thought about how terrible the reception was out there, how easily something intended to be simple could turn into a frustrating pain in the ass for everyone. But finally, what dawned on me was the fact that my son was turning 13. 13. He was going to be a teenager. As silly as this will sound, I was sort of stunned to realize we wouldn't always be spending his birthday together. I wouldn't always clear that day in my calendar. We wouldn't always go out to breakfast or to the granite quarry or a baseball game. We wouldn't go to McDonald's for fries and shakes, or as I like to call it, the vegetarian special. We wouldn't plan to haunt construction sites or watch farmers haying or go for ice cream afterward. There wouldn't be bowling parties or swimming. There wouldn't even be cake together or a pile of presents wrapped in goofy wrapping paper. There wouldn't be any need for me to arrange anything to do with his birthday. Never mind plan an entire day. Recovering, I decided to just let his birthday be his birthday. For the first time, without me. Instead, he would turn 13 with a bunch of dudes. It suddenly seemed more than a compromise. It seemed like the most fitting turn of events. On day one of his teenage years, he would be surrounded by men modeling how to be a good man, how to be capable and strong, how to be independent and encouraging, and above all, how to have fun without fear. He knew most of these men since he was young enough to remember things and has admired many of them for their senses of humor, their musical chops, their inappropriate jokes, and their adventurous spirits. You could do worse on your 13th birthday. You could be with your mom as she demands you wear a button-down shirt to a fancy breakfast. I asked for their help. I asked them to be my surrogates. I asked them to remember their 13-year-old selves, to give him advice, to just help him have a happy birthday. Sure, I was met with the level of smartassery I'd come to expect, like offers to bring their old playboys along as well as some outlining of male rites of passage, drinking cow's blood, waking at dawn. But underneath it all, every response told me, of course, we've got this. The weekend passed in radio silence. No texts, no calls, no FaceTiming, no nothing. My son had left as a 12-year-old, would return as a 13-year-old, and I hadn't even called him to wish him a happy birthday. I hadn't hugged him or lit a single candle. His presence awaited him on the dining room table in a house filled with silence. I pressed my girlfriends into service. I will cry all day if we don't do something. We had cocktails in the afternoon, went to see Wonder Woman, stayed up too late drinking whiskey and telling secrets from our own teenage years. It felt like the beginning of my life fully becoming mine again, even if for one night, even just for the weekend. I could see it. When they returned that Sunday, the regular rituals held. They were filthy and happy. They needed to shower, and everything they brought with them, pillows, sleeping bags, sneakers, needed to be washed in hot water. They were full of stories, although saved the narking for Monday morning when John left for work. They grow up so fast. John had brought a bunch of cupcakes for Walker's birthday, and it turned out my son shared his birthday with another boy on the trip. So there were lots of cupcakes and candles, singing and gorging. It was not fancy. It was great. No one overthought it. No one belabored it. I thought back to that best-worst camping trip, when I had given the kids permission to make as much noise as they wanted when they rose at 6 a.m. It was a delicious form of payback to our still-sleeping and undoubtedly excruciatingly hungover neighbors. I may have provided pots, pans, and wooden spoons to amplify their efforts. And I thought of the sovereign nation across from us as they slowly emerged from their tents. The campfire roaring again, coffee being made by and for tired and also hungover dads. Bowls of cereal and egg sandwiches being distributed as everyone huddled around a picnic table or the fire. A community like any community, but this one just happened to be bound by fresh air and super soakers. While John slept, I walked to the campground store to get a coffee, my kids racing ahead of me on their bikes. We had already been up far too long, and coffee couldn't wait. The damp coolness of the early morning was quickly giving way to another blazing summer day. We exited the wider path leading to the store, passing the freestanding payphone where we stopped to take photos. Something so standard in my youth, now a hands-on hips curiosity for my kids. As we got closer to the store, I looked over to one of the picnic tables, where two of the girls from the tequila-soaked fuckfest sat. Sunglasses firmly on, they were hunched over and clutching their cups of campground store coffee as if they were life rafts. We poked around the store. This was always one of my favorite parts about camping or vacationing somewhere remote and near water. How the overabundance of choice we live with every day as Americans is whittled down to this reduction sauce of vacation necessity. Lures and donuts, local newspapers and firewood. Matches, fishing line, jugs of water, butter and eggs, ice cream sandwiches, citronella candles, aloe and sunscreen, candy bars and aluminum foil. We need so little to get by, yet convince ourselves we always need more to be happy. We started to make our way back to our campsite, passing the tables and the girls again. I walked a few extra steps and then called to my kids, "Hey guys, why don't you go on ahead to the campsite? I'll meet you there." They looked at me with curious eyes, but the tone of my voice must have convinced them it was better to get out of there already. I backtracked and walked over to the picnic table, setting my coffee down and swinging my leg over to sit down as if we were old friends, as if I had been invited. They looked at me and I looked at them, which alone almost gave me a contact hangover. "So," I began, "I'm at the campsite right next to you." And the look on their faces all but said, "Fuck me." I continued, "Look, I totally get it. I know this is going to make me sound like your mom, but I was in my 20s once." Pause. "The thing is, I fucking love swearing. I love it. You can't imagine the level of control it takes for me not to swear in front of my kids." They looked uneasy. "But my kids had to listen to you guys swear for hours last night. Hours. And they heard some swears I'm not even sure I recognized. They are 8 and 10 years old, you guys, and they had to listen to all of that shit. Again, I get it. I get having a good time. But here's the thing. We also deserve to enjoy this park. This is our weekend, too. I've already complained to the park ranger. We're not having another night like that." They went on to tell me it was the guys who were the problem, that those same guys were leaving this morning and they were sorry. Not effusively, not like they owed me anything, but more to save face. More to make me just stop talking and go away already. I rose, tipped my coffee to them, and said, "Good. Have a nice day." I smiled the whole way back to our campsite. If you can't mess with someone 20 years younger than you while they're having one of the worst hangovers of their lives, what are you even doing? As our campsite bustled back into activity, and the campsite next to us went about preparing breakfast in a silent, even breathing is too loud stupor, shooting us wary looks, we were finally able to savor the best parts of this best-worst camping trip. We saw sunrises and sunsets. One sunset in particular, the most stunning I had ever seen, right on the summer solstice. My daughter waded around in the shallow water, and I snapped a photo of her, her silhouette sharp against the liquid orange light. I laid down after lunch in an open stretch of grass on a soft cotton blanket and listened to the buzzing of bees, the fluttering of bird wings so close. We had gathered pine cones and ferns, leaves of all shapes and feathers and a smidge of a robin's eggshell. I had taken in wildflowers bobbing back and forth in the breeze. We goose-stepped our way across rocks to go swimming, and we wolfed down Snickers ice cream bars at the campground store. It was one camping trip that started horribly and turned into something greater than we could have imagined. We stuck it out and were rewarded, when typically I would have cut bait and left, pissed off at the world. Dad camp is now a ritual that fills up Arctic winter days with the promise of better, warmer days to come. John takes care of reserving the sites and paying for them, arranging who goes where, and beyond that, I don't know any details. Happily. This past year, he left with the kids only a couple of hours after they came home from their last day of school, summer vacation starting immediately. He told me later that when he drove into the park and checked in at the office, the park ranger looked over the sites he had reserved and said with caution in his voice, "Now you know you're responsible for all of these sites, right? And for all of the behavior at these sites?" As he told me this story, we both laughed, and I said, "Burton Island. That's what he was expecting." That's when John explained that he understood, that this was actually the third year this big group had camped there, that it was a big group of dads and kids. That's when the ranger lit up and said, "Oh, it's you guys. We love you guys." Me too, park ranger. Me too. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. I have come face to face with gratitude every single day since the heartbeat on the monitor decided to keep beating, every time it continued to beat. And those 2 times I went to the hospital and left with a fully alive and complete baby, and every single moment since. I do not need to keep a journal to remind myself. I am grateful for my children's lives above all. I'm grateful they are not jerks, as far as I can tell. And I'm grateful they genuinely enjoy meeting and talking with our neighbors more than I do, therefore making them excellent spies. I am grateful they were both born years before the invention of the iPhone and social media, so when I nursed them, I had to occupy myself the old-fashioned way, by reading W and watching the Red Sox win their first World Series since 1918. I couldn't text or use emojis or email while lightly resting my elbows on my baby's sleeping body. Instead, I paged through copies of Vanity Fair, stared into space, stared at his face and his jaw or her closed sleeping eyelids with those searching eyes underneath.
I am especially grateful none of that existed, so when I was completely at my wit's end, I didn't also have to endure posts from other moms of their infants peacefully napping in cleanly designed cribs with modern color palettes and graphics, or babies who were bright-eyed and bushy-tailed smiling, always smiling, their gummy grins showing how happy they were to be alive. The best babies. That would have been fucking it, as I could barely shower or sleep or figure out what either of their problems were. I sweated through 2 summers with nonstop baby ragers covered in their own spit-up. If social media had existed, the only thing I probably would have been able to post would have been, "Do you guys like my armpit hair? I've been growing it out."
I have wished for a lot of things over the years.
I have wished for good health, like the good, getting older person that I am. In my 20s, I used to think, "At least you have your health," was a polite way of saying, "It's so sad you're so single and such a friggin' loser." I now know that wish is a good wish indeed.
I've wished for all good things for my kids, for them to be happy and safe, to be safe forever.
I've wished for them to have cheerful lives and retain their good, tender hearts.
I have hoped they find satisfaction and purpose in how they spend their days.
If they spend their days ticking off dates on a calendar, just waiting for something to happen, it would fracture my heart in about 3 places. I hope they will return to me always, happy and healthy, wanting to see me, not out of some sense of duty or because it's a holiday.
I have wished, more than anything, to have the kind of relationships with them I see and envy in others. I hope they won't make fun of me behind my back or roll their eyes when I call them to say I love and miss them. I hope they will love and miss me back.
I've wished misery upon their enemies and a smaller amount of misery upon people who are just plain mean to them. There's a part of me that's counting on lightning bolts of regret shooting at will from my fingertips and straight into the jugulars of those who wrong them. Pretty typical mom stuff. I have maintained an identity for myself more or less since the day my son was born. Less in those early hours and days and years, but then picking up with the speed and momentum of a runaway 18-wheeler ever since. I am building myself up at a breakneck speed, and to be honest, it feels fucking great.
I wonder if I am leaving my family in my wake, but I don't want to stop. I have stopped so many other times.
I think about how old my kids are now, 11 and 13, and I almost can't say their ages aloud. It's as if their birthdays were a surprise this year, almost as if they don't happen every year on exactly the same dates. I'm not sure how I got here, yet the gratitude I feel at having made it this far is overwhelming. I've spent years wishing for a bubble of personal space, only to discover that 12 is apparently the age when kids stop holding your hand. My daughter isn't quite there yet. When we were in Maine this past summer, I realized my son never reached for my hand. This vacation and that place was the one place that hand-holding was guaranteed, on our morning walks, us 2 early birds out for a stroll. I kept this in mind as my daughter and I walked to our joint haircut appointments the other afternoon. I stuck my hand out for her to grab, and I immediately realized how long it had been, because the motion felt awkward and surprising instead of automatic, the way it used to. It felt electric. She immediately grabbed for it, perhaps thinking the same thing in her own way. From the minute our hands clasped together, she started doing a skipping, sliding thing in her flip-flops. I think the joy she felt at holding hands was a big part of it. Her hair flowed and bounced behind her like a shampoo commercial. She felt safe and smaller, and it filled us both with joy. We should hold hands every chance we get, while we still can. I wish I could go back and talk to my new mother self and tell her all the things she should do differently. I would tell myself I shouldn't let anyone who hasn't had kids into our house in those first few weeks. That I will still feel the need to try to clean and do dishes, and there just isn't time for that shit, but I'll do it anyway. Then a friend who is not married and has no kids will breeze in with a gift and spend most of her time looking at me and wondering why I don't look happier. I will feel like I am going to explode. I will feel worse than I already felt, and I already felt plenty bad. I will wonder if, in addition to losing myself, I won't know that's temporary yet, I have also lost all my single, child-free friends. How could they ever understand what's happening to me? I won't even understand what's happening to me.
I should have made more friends immediately, as if I was a second grader. I shouldn't have been too proud or too shy to ask for walking dates or coffee dates where we could nurse side by side. I needed that. I should have asked for help sooner, even though I was raised to not ask for help, so it feels like the worst thing I could ever do. Even worse than asking for money. Someone, anyone, should have told me to be alone with my husband more. It seems so obvious now, but I'm talking 2004 and 2006, and super hot takes and listicles for what new moms should and shouldn't do didn't really exist back then.
Did they? Those were wildly different times, and how stupid is that?
Why does the world have to move along so fast?
Maybe one day it will move in reverse, and we will suddenly embrace taking long wagon rides across prairies, and we'll write with quill pens and ink. Remember the calligraphy craze back in the 1980s? What was that about?
Back to the marriage thing. We lost each other. In a big way. And we waited too long to do anything about it. We thought that once we had a reliable babysitter and more money, we could make up for lost time.
But a marriage is not a to-do list, and you can't just catch up in a flurry.
I remember friends of ours. Actually, they were my husband's friends first. I met them on our first date. Then they became our joint collective friends. I remember a conversation with the wife after they divorced. Even now, I still can't quite believe they're divorced. They were so fun and great together. They were easy to spend time with. I genuinely liked and like both of them so much. And she said, "It was just so hard after the kids were born.
You think it will come back one day?"
I remember thinking, one day when the kids are grown, we'll look back on this and laugh. Instead, he told me he didn't love me anymore and wanted a divorce.
Sometimes you don't look back and laugh.
Sometimes you just get a divorce. I wish I had heard that story before we had kids, or maybe right when they were born. I needed to hear that earlier. I needed to hear it often. I'm not sure how much we can do about it all now. Maybe it's too late. We each slept on the couch for months, trying to keep one or the other kid asleep.
To say we were two ships passing in the night would be a disservice to ships passing in the night, which sounds downright sexy compared to what was actually happening.
We would soundlessly pass one sleeping kid off to the other, or I would hand him a yowling baby with an angry, "I will throw this baby against the wall if someone doesn't get her away from me." We did all our sleeping and napping with kids on us at some point. We fed ourselves breakfast and read only the headlines from the front page of the paper, all while bouncing a bouncy seat with one foot.
A one-man band. We swaddled and attachment parented the shit out of those kids.
And yet, apparently we should have been doing some attachment marriaging as well. Just because you can do something, just because you can push yourselves to the limit, just because you can work 60 hours or not take vacations or not go out to dinner with your partner or not even start the day with a hug and a kiss and a, "Yeah, this is insane, but we've got this," doesn't mean you should. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. I have said this like a mantra ever since. I wish I could be easier on myself, although the evidence clearly shows being hard on myself works. I do get what I want, mostly.
I do not get things handed to me, although frankly it would be nice at this point. Like, you know how celebrities get goodie bags stuffed with La Mer and tennis bracelets at award shows? They already have money, and lots of it. No one should be giving them shit for free. But now, I'd like a piece of that action.
I wish I could have just one day of knowing what it would be like to walk around with a supermodel ass. It must be amazing. I wish there was something like that.
Like instead of fantasy baseball camp, there could be fantasy supermodel ass camp. I would go to that. I'd pay double.
I wish I could know what's going to happen next. But even if I had the opportunity to find out, even if someone could tell me, I would refuse. Even if they promised it would be great, I would be too nervous to find out.
I wish I could stop wishing. I wish I could just say, "Thank you. This is enough. This is plenty.
Look at me, being grateful." Last. You are all the joy. Allow me to embarrass you. No matter what you believe, I actually don't do this nearly enough. You, both of you, are the soft hands that are getting rougher, from cartwheels and riding bikes, scrambling over rocks and grass like long-limbed crabs. Those hands have gone from stubby things that poke out of a mush of baby pudge to long, slender instruments. And although I keep thinking you must have the longest, most slender fingers on Earth, I realize that calling Guinness World Records over them is perhaps a step too far. Regardless, I admire them frequently. I never tell you that, because is it weird for your mother to admire your long fingers? I think it might be. But this is what we do. You are the velvety, pillowiest cheeks. I've let my lips linger on those cheeks more than on any other cheeks before or since. And even though you are now 11 and 13, you give me this much. You let me linger and kiss your cheeks. Not in front of your friends. I mean, you haven't lost your minds. But at bedtime, I can still do that. I can also hold your head in my hands and make smooshy goldfish faces with your mouths or beep your nose and smooth your hair. Your faces have meant more to me than any other faces, because yours are the only faces on this earth I saw first. Even before that, I felt them inside me, and honestly, how weird is that? It's getting weirder the more distant those days become and the taller you grow. Your faces were built inside my own body, an eyebrow from here and a nose from there. I'm not sure where those cheeks came from, but I'm so happy they're here. Although in your faces I see traces and features from our family's past, I mostly just see you, in all your meandering weirdness and wide-open souls, your confusion and sadness, your fart jokes and naughtiness, your love. I see the whole of you as you are. And when I see your eyes well up, it hurts me more than if I was just crying myself. Seeing either of you sad is the saddest I ever feel. You are the eyes that are the only eyes in existence to see how I actually am as a mother. So no matter what I write or post or tell other people, only you know the truth. I have failed you daily, I know. I have paid attention when you weren't interested and not paid attention when you begged for my undivided eyes and ears. I wish I could go back and do it all perfectly or even start from this square right here, but I can't. I have the best of intentions and then just let them fade, and now you are both at the ages where you call me out on it. You said we would definitely do this today, and I knew it wouldn't happen. I just knew it. I don't want to wish that one day you will feel overwhelmed, that you will feel the tug between your own life and the lives of your children and the goals you set for yourself, and how none of that fits neatly together. If it's a puzzle, it could only be the kind of puzzle that you get at a yard sale, a bag full of random pieces thrown together, and good luck with that. But I hope eventually you will understand how I feel now. If only for a day, if only to know I was trying to do just enough to make it all work. Not do it all well, and certainly not do it all flawlessly, because obviously that's impossible. But to be all in on team good enough. Maybe there is never such a thing as good enough when it's your own mother. Maybe the only way to know for sure is to have your own kids. It just seems with all our technology, we should be able to leapfrog that a bit. Maybe a virtual reality have kids and keep trying to live your own individual life and feel overwhelmed by all of that experience could take place of the home ec classes that are sporadically taught and still very much needed. The carrying around of a hard-boiled egg or a sack of flour bit doesn't even come close. Your eyes are drawn from us, that much is clear. You with Dad's eyes and you with mine, sort of. They are big, beautiful eyes, perfectly suited to your faces. I almost can't take them in. They overwhelm me. Together we have seen chapters upon chapters through those eyes. We have seen how unpredictable and scary a crowd can look, even if, before you were born, that crowd would have looked fine to me. You have taught me how to see a bucket loader and an excavator, because those are apparently two different things. And you have showed me the teeniest, tiniest flowers, the inchworms or neighborhood dogs or spotted piglets. And that I really shouldn't be worried about you when you jump from a crazy high boulder into an untamed swimming hole. I will still worry. We have been looking into each other's eyes since the first time you were each laid upon my chest and in my drugged-up trying-not-to-hyperventilate state. Because as it turns out, you get cold fast when you've been sliced open and you can't feel half your body, and honestly, was I really awake for that? I remember those eyes. And each time I looked and saw those eyes, I thought,
Of course.
All those months of wondering what you would look like, of churning my imagination in an attempt to see all the possible faces, and of course, when you were born, you looked completely